Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you're a computer programmer or a security guard in your 20s or a working old-timer, you're probably feeling the pinch. Less job security, slim pay raises, more worries about making ends meet at the grocery store, gas pump, in retirement. All this while corporate profits, economic growth, and productivity have been strong. This hour on Point, what's gone wrong for American workers? Joining us today from Los Angeles is Stephen Greenhouse, labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. His big new book is The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Stephen Greenhouse, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Very nice to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, working man himself. Jack, good to have you.
Good to have you. Welcome back, Tom. And Stephen, hello.
It's great to be here. Steve Greenhouse, you've got facts and figures galore in this book, and they are some pretty startling ones, but I wish you'd start out with some very human stories. The stories of Mike Mitchell and Myra Bronstein just really struck me. I wish you'd give us sort of the outlines of each, if you would, as examples of what you're writing about.
Fine. Mike was a security guard for several Walmarts down in Texas, and his job was to basically catch shoplifters, thieves, and over a two-year period, he caught 180 shoplifters.
So he was good at it.
He was very good at it, yes. And one afternoon, his manager summoned him and said, there's someone using Kaida checks, and Mike started running after this person, and she ran into the parking lot. Her accomplice, she jumped into her car, her accomplice gunned the accelerator, ran right into Mike. He had two herniated discs, a torn rotator cuff, and his kneecap was banged up. So miraculously, he returned to work the next day, even though he'd been in the hospital.
Yeah.
And he tried to be a hero. And a few weeks later, he announced that he had to have surgery on his knee and go on workers' comp. And a few weeks later, he was fired. And, you know, Mike is convinced that he was fired because Walmart has a policy of, or some Walmart managers have a policy of trying to get rid of workers who file for workers' comp because it runs up the store's expenses. Myra Bronstein had quite a different story. She was college educated. She had a degree to be a software engineer. She was working outside Seattle at a software company. The company told her that as long as we're in business, as long as you work hard, Myra, you'll have a job. And she worked very hard. Many days she worked 14, 16, 18-hour days. And then one day, boom, Myra and 17 other software engineers were, you know, told to attend a meeting where they were told that they were being fired. And she felt betrayed. And making things worse was Myra and the 17 others were told that if they want any severance pay whatsoever, they had to spend the next 4 weeks training the replacements from India who would be taking their jobs. And they all agreed, and the next Monday, there they were in the kind of degrading position of having to train these 20 workers who were flown in from India to take their jobs.
Who henceforth would, at a much lower wage in India, sit halfway around the world doing what they had done while she was out of work, she and her cohorts.
Yes, Tom. The numbers were stark. Myra told me that she was making about $80,000 a year as a software engineer, and she was told that the workers from India who were, yes, going to return to India to do her job, we're going to make only $5,000 a year.
You paint a picture here which is really disturbing of American workers in what the space of a generation going from kind of the envy of the world to somewhere near the bottom of the bucket of the first world in terms of health coverage, pension benefits, job security, workload, stress levels, wages. I mean, just right across the board, what is going on here, Stephen?
The nation has faced many pressures over the past few years, and I write in the book that in the 50s and 60s, you know, the United States, American workers were the envy of workers around the nation, and there was this wonderful social contract where corporations, which were quite profitable, were paying good wages, were providing excellent benefits, health benefits, pension benefits, and during the 50s and 60s, basically both white collar and blue collar American workers had good job security. Things really changed in the 70s and 80s with the advent of strong global competition, you know, first in the apparel industry, then, as we all know, in the auto industry and the steel industry. And as American corporations faced much more competition, they started to treat their workers harder. They clamped down on wages. Job security increasingly went out the window. Now, the difficult thing in many ways is that corporate America has recovered a lot over the past few years. This is before the current recession. And, you know, profits for American corporations have really doubled over the past 7 years. Yet, as you said in the introduction, Tom, you know, wages have really remained flat. And not only that, the percentage of Americans and American workers with health insurance is going down. We're seeing good traditional pensions going out the window for many workers, and they're being replaced by 401ks, which are not nearly as good in assuring retirement security and making things worse. And I talk about what's happening to many individual workers is even as wages are stagnant, even as benefits are getting worse, American workers are being pushed to work harder than ever before. And we have this crazy situation where the typical American worker works about 240 hours more than the typical French worker. That's six full-time weeks a year. And the typical American worker works like 350, 360 hours more than the typical German worker. That's like nine full-time work weeks. So Americans are being squeezed on pay, and they're being squeezed on how much they work.
You've got tremendous numbers in here and a lot of nuance as well in the stories that you tell about the – it ends up feeling like the thousands, the millions of ways in which people get squeezed, adding up to the big squeeze that you describe. We're going to get into all of that and hear from our listeners, people in that working world. And it's really right across the board here. We're not talking just fast food servers. We're talking, you know, right up into the heart of the American working population. Jack Beattie, you're listening along here. I wonder if you've got some perspective on work now and work then and just where we've traveled over these recent decades.
Yes. Well, this urgently important book, I think, really brings it home to me, what things were like then. I mean, consider the 1960s. Real family incomes went up 41%. Michael Harrington's book, The Other America, with which I'd compare this one, was really about the invisible Americans, the poor, that the not seen in the affluent society. Harrington assumed that the rest of the society was doing pretty well. Now, of course, the conditions that were confined to the poor then are more and more creeping into what used to be the middle class today. But one way to bring it home, what the difference was, is just my own story. I was a high school dropout, and yet in 1967, I earned $8,000 as a truck driver in the Teamsters Union. And I not only that, I got my rotten teeth replaced, which I would never free. That was part of the union dues.
Was $8,000 good pay then, Jack?
Well, let me tell you how good it was. Lionel Trilling that same year was earning about $14,000 as a university professor at Columbia. So yeah, that was real good. And not only was it good for a high school dropout, but the working conditions, the workplace was entirely different. What's shocking to me in this book, Stephen, is just how mean the workplace has become, how much abuse people have to take. By contrast, I made a terrible mistake. I delivered a load of bales to South Boston that should have gone to Chelsea. And over the radio, my boss cursed me, just every. And I'm driving home that night, and I'm thinking, I'm so stupid, I can't even go to the right place. I've lost this job. What's going to happen? I get out of the truck. There's the union steward, Kenny McCarron, God rest his soul. And he signals to me, come on. We walk into the boss's office. The boss stands up, buttons his coat, reaches out his hand and says, I apologize. Please accept my apology. I walk out the door and I say, what goes? And Kenny McCarron says, listen, you can't talk to a Teamsters Union member like that. That's undignified. We'd strike over that. And he said, and by the way, you are a blankety blank, blankety blank.
That, the two-way radio had a hot conversation and suddenly it's truck driver Stephen Greenhouse, truck driver Jack Beattie, who gets the apology. I mean, Jack's right. The stories you tell in this book are of a very, very different relationship with workers. Jack says just how mean. It's a simple word, but there's a kind of meanness in the treatment of workers you illustrate over and over here, Stephen.
Unfortunately, that's correct. I'm not saying that's the case at every company, but generally in corporate America, there's greater pressure from up top to the line managers, the mid-level managers, the store managers, the restaurant managers, you know, to keep their payroll to a minimum, to get things moving. And, you know, the pressures from the top are so vast that many lower-level managers do nasty things. And I write about, you know, how many workers, you know, are victims of, you know, cheating by management. They have to work off the clock, meaning they have to work hours that are unpaid. I tell the stories of an Air Force veteran who worked for Toys R Us, Family Dollar, very well-known companies, and at three different companies where he worked, managers went into the computer and shaved hours that people work in order to minimize payroll. And I have a chapter that's called Leaner and Meaner. And yes, it's important for American corporations to be lean to compete with each other and compete globally. But unfortunately, too many times managers are becoming meaner. And there are lots of unpleasant stories about that, too many unpleasant stories about that. I try to leaven things in part by also talking about some model corporations later on in the book.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about working Americans in an unforgiving economy. My guest is Stephen Greenhouse. He's labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. He's out with a big new book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Jack Beatty's here as well. We've got a lot of listeners calling in. But, Stephen, I want you to just lay out a couple more stories in a nutshell here. Dawn Eubanks, tell us her story.
Dawn was an Army vet. She, after leaving the Army, she needs a job. She finds a job at a call center in Florida, and things are fairly crazy there. Some days she shows up for work, and they say, you can't clock in, sit in the lobby for a few hours, and we'll call you when we need you. So she might sit around in the lobby for 2, 3, 4 hours unpaid. Then they call her in, and she clocks in for 3, 4 hours. And some days she got sick of it and wanted to go home, and she was told that if she went home, even though she was not clocked in, she'd be fired. It would be considered as if she were walking away, abandoning her job. And this, unfortunately, is part of, you know, you use the word nasty and mean, Tom. You know, I think there's been a change in the mentality of many corporate managers, and I try to lay that out in the book, that it seems that, you know, and it's hard to explain why, in the 50s and 60s, maybe after World War II, there's more solidarity totally within the United States, you know, managers seem to treat workers much better. Now, many managers are just treating workers very shabbily.
And I mean, that's the story of a naked worker, of a worker with no leverage. Tell us the story of Antonio Lopez Paz.
Antonio worked in a poultry plant in Tennessee, and she faced the same situation like a Walmart worker I wrote about, Verrett Richardson in Kansas City. Both of them were told, basically, we're not going to give you breaks to go to the bathroom except at lunchtime and when you have coffee breaks. And, you know, Antonia told me that, you know, where she worked on the poultry line, many of the women, unfortunately, ended up soiling themselves because they weren't given bathroom breaks. And, you know, she told me the story of one worker next to her who asked her manager, saying, I need to go. And the manager held out his hard hat and said, you can go to the bathroom in this.
Sounds like the third world, but it's not. It's in this country.
Yes, it's in Morristown, Tennessee.
Don Jensen.
Don's, you know, a wonderful gentleman, a college degree. He was one of the heads of recruiting for very respectable company, Lucent, a high-tech company.
That's a long way from a poultry chopping line.
Yes,
here.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Don was in charge of recruiting graduates from some respectable colleges like Stanford and Cornell and MIT. And he retired after 25, 30 years at Lucent, and he thought he was going to have a nice, relaxing retirement playing golf. His pension was about $35,000 a year, and he was going to get retiree health coverage through Lucent. And in the first year of retirement, it was just going to be $180 a year. And 3 years later, all of a sudden, his retiree health coverage was going to cost more than $8,000, about a quarter of his pension. And
The company just jacked it up. That was just the way it is.
Just jacked it up, just forced it upon them. And Jensen could no longer make ends meet. So what did he do? He took a job as a $10 an hour bank teller to get coverage. And this shows how, you know, workers who thought they were in good position all of a sudden find themselves squeezed terribly.
You know, I was sitting just last week with a retired, a parent of a friend out in California, and she was saying, looking out on the country, that this country is becoming more like a third world country. And I sort of shook my head. I'm looking around. There's California. You know, the life looks very nice. And I thought, that's such an exaggeration. And then I'm reading you, and you're writing, you know, income inequality, at least by that measure. The U.S. now looks more like a third world country than most advanced industrial nations.
Richard Freeman, a terrific economist at Harvard, has written a book. And he says that income inequality is so vast in the United States that it much more resembles a typical third world country than an industrial country. And over the past generation or so, the top 1% has taken much more of the nation's income than was the case. The top 1% in 1980 received about 9% of the nation's income. Now that's up to 21-22%, and that leaves much less, or considerably less, for the other 99%. And we have a situation where for middle-class Americans, the middle fifth, income over the past 25 years has gone up about 21%. And that's mainly because women, wives, spouses are working many more hours than before. So for the typical middle-class household, income is up 21% over the past quarter century. For the top 1%, income is more than triple. It's up 228%. And unfortunately, one of the reasons, Tom, that wages are stagnant and benefits are going down is that more and more of the nation's income is going to the top 1%.
Why is this happening in the United States and not in some of these other countries that you've named, other first world industrialized nations? Why to such a greater degree in this country?
It is happening somewhat in the other countries, but you're absolutely right, Tom. It's happening worse here. And there are many reasons. Partly in European countries, say, there's just more, they use the phrase social solidarity in Europe, that, you know, the people on top want to make sure that the people in the middle and the people in the bottom are doing pretty well. And, you know, there are higher minimum wages there. The unions are stronger there. You know, one big reason why workers in America are doing worse is that unions have grown much weaker over the past quarter century. And in Europe, unlike the United States, there are many more rules protecting workers on job security, on minimum wage, on, you know, generous unemployment if you're laid off. And, you know, America, you know, one of the things that struck me in writing the book is, you know, America is the only wealthy country in the world where the national government does not require at least several weeks vacation for workers. You know, I write that in Europe, in the European Union countries, everyone is guaranteed at least 4 weeks vacation. Here, unfortunately, you meet many workers who, you know, get no vacation whatsoever in their first year or two of work. Mm. Another big difference that shocked me was, again, the United States is the only wealthy industrial country where there's no federal law guaranteeing workers paid sick days. So here, you know, many companies, if you have to take 2 days off because you're very sick or because your kid is very sick, you're not paid those days, and sometimes you risk getting fired. And the third thing that surprised me is, again, the United States is the only, you know, wealthy industrial nation where there's no paid maternity leave. Indeed, we're only one of the four nations in the world, including three very backward third world nations, we're only one of the only four nations that doesn't have paid maternity leave.
But we're a democracy, so we're voting for this. Listeners, what do you think about all this? What do you make of this picture? Stephen Greenhouse is with us. His book is The Big Squeeze. Stephen, Jack, stand by. Susan is calling from Boston. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm just calling to make a comment. My husband has worked for IBM as a software engineer for over 15 years. And for the past 3 years, he's gotten the top in terms of performance evaluation, mm-hmm. but no salary increases whatsoever, not even a cost of living allowance.
And how, so, I mean, IBM, big name, 15 years, a good long time. How is that justified? What do they say to him, Susan?
That they, it's a competitive market, and they, you know, they have to make sure that the software group is making their dollars. But health insurance has gone up. As we know, gas prices, oil prices, and food have all gone up. So we're essentially going backwards.
Have you together thought about him leaving that job?
Oh, yes. Looking around at other, but, you know, it seems as though the industry is flat right now, as your the person that's on there with you right now is talking about, that the industry seems to be flat. But I just wanted to make that quick comment.
Well, that's
thank you for addressing this issue.
Sure, you bet. Stephen Greenhouse, there it is, straight from the front, and not here from Walmart, but from IBM. 15 years, top ratings, software worker, and zero increases in 3 years. I mean, we all know what's going on with inflation. Susan's right. That is a pay cut.
Absolutely. You know, Susan's story is fascinating. I interviewed a good number of IBM stories for the book, and they'd say, if you got the top rating, as Susan's husband did, then you normally got a raise. It was the people in the second and third ranks who did not get the great grades, who did not get raises. So it's alarming to hear that even if you get a great performance rating, you're not getting a raise. And I'm sure IBM, like many, many companies, say we're facing more foreign competition and we have to hold down our costs. And unfortunately, part of the message is, you know, if you folks demand too much in terms of a raise, we'll just move your jobs to India or to China. And that's, you know, one of the pressures, Tom, that American workers are facing, you know, very heavy global competition, you know, like Myra Bronstein, mm-hmm. whom I discussed earlier,
right.
You know, they see that, you know, if their wages get, quote, too high, unquote, you know, the companies could just move their jobs overseas.
But this also illustrates how deeply into the American working population this goes. You're not just talking about chicken processors in Tennessee or Arkansas here. You're talking way up. How deep into the working population does this dynamic, the squeeze you're describing, go?
I have this line I like, and I'm sorry for praising a line that I wrote. I write that globalization used to hit just the Bud crowd, but now it's hitting the Starbucks crowd. And back in the 1980s,
Bud as in Budweiser.
Budweiser, yes. Mm-hmm. And you know, back in the 1980s, the United States really started feeling the beginning of globalization. You know, as you know, the auto industry was hammered by Toyota, the steel industry was really hammered by imports from Brazil and Romania and Russia, and a lot of blue-collar workers lost their jobs. Now we're feeling the sting of globalization. The white-collar workers are very much feeling the sting of globalization, like Susan's husband at IBM. I think that's one of the main reasons, you know he's not getting a raise. And, you know, we're competing with India. We're competing with China. There are many terrific engineers in Russia and Hungary and the Czech Republic. And that's putting huge pressures on American white-collar workers, software engineers, architects, accountants, database managers. And, you know, one consulting firm estimates that over a 12-year period, the United States is going to lose more than 3 million jobs to offshoring. And, you know, so workers have to worry not only about losing their jobs, but the pressures from offshoring, help push down wages. So globalization is hurting many Americans, you know, not just the person who works in a shoe factory or in a apparel plant in South Carolina, North Carolina, but also, you know, terrific, you know, well-educated workers at IBM like Susan's husband. Mm-hmm.
That was not the way I think we were told it was supposed to work. We'll think about whether that's necessary, whether it has to be that way. Let's get a call from Bristol, Connecticut, and Newt. Hi, Newt, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
One of the biggest problems we're having now is basically a domino effect. America is becoming a country that doesn't make anything. We make money. A lot of people make money by moving money around, and now you have a lot of big corporations that are laying off workers and downsizing their workforce, not because they're not making money, but because they made $10 billion in profit last year, and it doesn't look like they're going to make $10 billion profit again, so they lay off. You know, they're still making astronomical profits, but they want to make more and more and more in every year. And we're becoming a more country.
Well, I mean, growth is kind of what has driven the country for a long time, but maybe there's something different about the way that more is being measured and made now. Newt, we'll look at that. Thanks for your call. Stephen Greenhouse, how about it? Somewhere I'm reading, was it in your book, about the shift from industrial capitalism to financial capitalism? Newt says, you know, it's all about numbers and just moving cash, not moving product anymore. What do you say to that? Does it relate to your theme?
Yes, I think Newt makes a good point. You know, I write in the book about how it's like almost a secret in the United States that since the year 2000, America has lost 1 in 5 of its manufacturing jobs, which is a huge amount, 3.5 million manufacturing jobs. Those are usually good, well-paying, middle-class jobs that have good health and retirement benefits. And 1 in 5 has disappeared, and you wouldn't know about it if you read the nation's newspapers or listen to people in Washington. It's finally come up in the past few months in the campaign. And a lot of people say, well, we don't need manufacturing jobs. We have these great financial jobs on Wall Street. And maybe I'm a bit old-fashioned, but I think there's real value to good manufacturing jobs. They do, provide good wages, good benefits, a good lifestyle for people with only a high school education. And as many people know, manufacturing jobs create many other spin-off jobs, in transportation, for messengers, for accountants. And, financial jobs are good, but I think in the current economic recession that we seem to be entering, a lot of people are saying, hey, these financial jobs aren't all they're cracked up to be. Look at how Bear Stearns, vaporized in a few days. They were concocting all such extraordinarily complicated financial instruments that it was resting on a foundation of sand in many ways. And to address your point for a second, Tom, when the nation was more industrial-based, manufacturing-based, there was a huge emphasis on, maximizing production to compete, to get market share. And I think as the nature of American capitalism has changed to a more financial-based capitalism, the thrust has been much more on minimizing costs and not maximizing production. I think that's one reason the nation has lost so many manufacturing jobs. Many financial investors are pushing American corporations to move their operations overseas.
From the FDR way to the Jack Welch way, the former head of GE who described very often workers as a cost. Jack, I want to get you, but let me get one more call here quickly before the break from Toronto, Canada. Athlee, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say that one of the reasons why there is a meanness taking place in corporations today is because the MBA programs at the university, and I happen to have been a student of one of them, teaches you to just look at the bottom line. They put you as a student under incredible pressure, and you're not given any introduction into dealing kindly with your employers. Or your employees.
So never mind the worker. Think about the bottom line. But hasn't it always been something like that, Athlee? I mean, companies always needed to make money.
Oh, yeah, I recognize that. But, what they forget is that your best resource is your employee. That's your best resource.
Jack Beatty, Athlee, says, we're getting what we train for. We're training MBAs to look at the bottom line with the blinkers on and nothing else, and here's the society that we get.
Yes, and they're working for publicly traded corporations where there's a fiduciary responsibility on the manager to produce the best the result each
yes,
quarter.
Yes, there is, sure.
Of course, the revolutionary idea that perhaps we ought to pass regulation making capital more patient, that people have to keep their investments longer in companies. When Jim Wright floated that idea shortly afterwards, he was out of Congress
the
for
hook.
A book scandal.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about working Americans in an unforgiving economy. My guest is Stephen Greenhouse, labor and workplace correspondent for The New York Times. His new book is The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Jack Beatty's with us as well. Have you felt, are you in the grip of the squeeze Stephen Greenhouse is writing about? John's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Really like the show. I listen every day.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah. My story is this. I have two jobs. I'm a project manager for a big construction company that takes me in three different states, 6 days a week on average, and with a lot of stress related to it.
Okay.
I had to take a second job delivering newspapers in the early morning. So I get up at 2:30 in the morning and deliver papers till 6 or 6:30 in the morning. And it's this company that I want to talk about. And to give you an example, you get roughly 6 cents for delivering a newspaper.
Okay.
If you make a mistake, if you make a mistake or the customer claims they didn't get the paper, or for whatever reason, and there are all kinds of examples of what could happen, but they clearly take the customer's side, which makes sense. And then the company that I work for charges you $2.50 for that cost. So, which means you can do the math. If you get 6 cents for delivering the paper, you have
right.
to now, you know, make that delivery, how many times, 20 times or something, before you recover the cost of that $2.50.
More than, plenty more than. So one mistake, you get it on the wrong side of the sidewalk or driveway, and you're out many deliveries. But John, let me ask you, how can it be that you're a construction manager working in six states? I mean, that sounds like a pretty significant job with a lot of responsibility. How can it be that with that kind of job, you also need to get up at 2:30 in the morning to deliver newspapers?
Because I have three children in college, one at Harvard, one at Northeastern, and a third at the University of Montana. So the income from the newspaper thing, every single penny of it goes to pay for the tuition costs at the University of Montana.
But it sounds almost undoable. You got construction projects in several states.
Let me tell you, I'm exhausted. I didn't sleep 5 hours in the last 40. So but the gouging thing on the part of the company that owns the delivery thing is what I wanted to talk about. And virtually every single delivery person talks about this on a daily basis, that they really find this as a profit center. So they know the drill. They know that there could be a 100 different reasons why a newspaper gets either misdelivered or delivered wrong or not put on the porch next to the planter the way the customer wants it.
Right.
And you get that $2.50 charge, and then you have to deliver 20 times to recover.
But how much can you make delivering newspapers in a week? I mean,
Tom. Not much. I mean, it really depends what tips you over a little bit of a scale and bumps you into maybe a $15 an hour job is with the tipping.
You know, let's make it real here. I'm guessing where you live, the company that you deliver newspapers for may be the same one Stephen Greenhouse works for, the New York Times.
Yeah.
So Stephen Greenhouse here, way down at the bottom of your own company's food chain, is John. What do you say?
I don't want to bite the hand that feeds me, so I'll be careful in this answer. No, what the situation Tom faces is very difficult, and there are many people who have what seem to be regular jobs but then are unfortunately treated as independent contractors, and I suspect that might be happening to Tom.
John in Gloucester, yeah.
John, sorry. And normally if you were an employee, they could not fine you $2.40 per house. But that since they treat you as an independent contractor, they have this freedom to do so. In the book, I write a very dismaying story about a Federal Express driver.
Absolutely dismaying. I wish you'd tell that. It may flesh out John's predicament.
She was from Brockton, just south of Boston. She worked for FedEx for 10 years. She was considered a model driver. Whenever it was a new hire, they would drive around with Jean because she was considered such a terrific driver. And like many FedEx drivers, she had to wear the shoes that FedEx told her to wear the color socks, have the hair cut, drive the truck that they ordered, have the racks in the truck arranged the way they wanted.
Even though she's paid as an independent contractor, they're telling her what kind of haircut she can have.
Yes, exactly. So, tragically, unfortunately, after 10 years there, Jean was stricken with ovarian cancer. So she thought, I'll put in for a leave of absence during my 3 months of chemotherapy. She had a fairly serious operation. She applied for the leave of absence for 3 months. They said, we'll get back to you. A month later, she got a letter in the mail saying, guess what? You're terminated. And she was livid. And she said, how could you fire me? You have to accommodate me under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Yeah.
Where you have to, keep people who have cancer and other diseases. And they said, sorry, you're wrong, Gene. You're an independent contractor. You're no longer handling your job because because you're sick, and we could fire you.
And you've got to tell the truck piece of this story, because that just amazed me, the ownership of the truck.
So, Jean, who's not a wealthy woman, she was netting maybe $30,000, $35,000 a year, even though she was working like 60 hours a week. So at the time she was fired, she had paid like $50,000, $55,000 in payments toward her truck. To buy the truck fully, you have to make 5 years of payments. She had made 4 years of payments.
And all FedEx workers, drivers, have to do this. I mean, they're all out there, unless they paid it off, they're out there buying their truck.
Generally, yes, Tom.
Okay.
And so after laying out, more than a year's income for her truck, Jean's truck is repossessed because she was in the hospital on chemotherapy and was fired and just didn't have the money to continue the payments for her truck. So not only was she fired, but she was out the value of like $40,000 for her truck.
You know, Jack Beatty, when you get to this extreme of the story, and there's John working to put his three kids through college, that's not easy for anyone, though 2:30 in the morning every day plus a full-time job, holy cow. But here's Jean. You know, she's paid off 4 of 5 years paying down her truck. She wears the socks they tell her to. She gets sick, and she's completely deep-sixed by FedEx, for whom she's a model driver.
Yeah, there's no loyalty. It's an antique idea today. And you say, well, what could reverse this? You know, what? How could we get a better, a fairer economy? Well, what was in place that gave us a fairer economy yesterday? Unions. They were 35% of the private sector workforce. Now, Stephen tells us, they're just about 7%. Therefore, there's no pressure. It's between you and your employer. You don't have the 1.5 million members of the Teamsters Union behind you, as I did in 1967. So what can bring back unions? Well, there's a thing called card check. No elections for a union. Just sign a card. You're in the union if a majority signs it. Republicans filibustered in the last Congress. Does it have a chance of passing in a new one? Probably only if the Democrats get 60 seats in the Senate. Will they? Very unlikely. You say, well, what about medical issues? We don't have medical insurance. That's a major problem of insecurity. Is that apt to pass, something like national health care under either of the Democrats? Well, there's going to be a heck, as Stephen says, there's going to be a huge fight from the lobbies against that. We just don't know. Taxes. In the 1950s, the top marginal rate, 91% on the wealthy. As late as 1964, after the Kennedy tax cut, 70% on the wealthy. Now, what is it, 36%? And according to Frank Levy at MIT in a recent paper, these things, these institutional changes, unions, a government that was basically committed to the unions, high marginal tax rates on the rich, that money going back into public works to benefit everybody, and also different norms. Corporate chieftains were ashamed in those days, or would have been, to do the things that they're doing now. All of these things were behind our prosperity then, and it's hard to see how we get more prosperity back without something like going back and getting them again.
Stephen, the power of your book comes from the way it sort of drives straight into the middle of the political economy we're working in and explodes in there. The big story we've all seen and been told is that the greater kind of market dynamic in our economy has produced great prosperity in the last 20, ever since the sort of morning in America, Reagan years. And there's no question you've seen the growth and you've seen the productivity up. I mean, you've interviewed thousands of workers, and if it's not working for the American worker, then in some sense it's just not working, unless I'm missing something here.
That's true, Tom. And you know, one of the big mysteries is, you know, you see the recent New York Times CBS poll saying that, 81% of Americans think the country is very seriously off on the wrong track. Mm. And I think a lot of that is, you know, over lack of income growth, worse benefits, more stress on the job. You know, certainly the Iraq War comes into play, certainly the recession. And you kind of wonder, why aren't American workers more up in arms about what's happening at the workplace? And, you know, we read the newspapers and, you know, they often say there's a lot of economic growth, there's a lot of economic growth. And I think a lot of workers just feel, well, it's only me who's not enjoying wage increases. And one of the things I seek to explain in the book is that this is fairly system-wide, nationwide. It's not just you having to pay more for your health insurance or losing health insurance. It's happening to millions, to tens of millions of Americans. It's not just you losing your good pension and getting a lousy 401k. It's happening across the system. I'm trying to make, you know, Americans understand that there's something going on here, there's something out of balance, and we all have to recognize what's happening and try to figure out how to improve things. Mm-hmm. And one thing I do in the book is I hold out some companies as model examples, like Patagonia and Costco and Ernst & Young, and they do a wonderful job in treating their workers well, with dignity, with respect, with all the things that Jack Beatty wants for workers. And you know, they go the extra mile in sharing their profits with their workers and creating work-family balance, so that, you know, your job isn't so demanding and stressful that it, you know, prevents you from spending time with your spouse or your kids. And it's nice, I think, to read about some companies that really do the right thing.
But could they really be a model, be models for the country when the global competition you're talking about is sitting out there as a fact? Can individual companies really be the thing that turn this around? Could more companies adopt their policies and still be profitable when they're up against the kind of competition you also described?
Yes, Tom. I'm not saying all can, but I think a lot of companies could, you know, put a little emphasis, a little less emphasis on maximizing profit and being somewhat more generous about, you know, sharing their profits, their prosperity with their workers. You know, they could say, you know, let's give paid sick days to our workers. Let's give an extra week of vacation to our workers. Yes, this might make some companies less competitive. It will increase costs. But I think, on the other hand, it will make some workers more loyal, more productive, less stressed out. And when workers are less stressed out, they're often more creative and more productive. And I'm not saying, you know, every company can be a Costco or a Patagonia, but many more can adopt some of the nice policies, the enlightened policies that these companies have.
Let's get a couple more calls here if we can. Chad in Groton, Massachusetts. Chad, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to check in this morning to talk a bit about my experience. I just left a job in the financial industry that I had had for 10 years. Mm-hmm. It was a good job. I made over $100,000. I had benefits. I had 4 weeks vacation. I did have a pension, which got turned into defined contribution. And we talked a little bit about defined contribution this morning, but,
right,
you know, less than about 25% of American workers don't even contribute to 401ks when it's available. And then another large percentage of the people who do contribute actually make less than market returns because they don't have the sophistication to understand how to invest in the market.
So they're kind of on their own. But what you walked away from is a package that sounds like one a lot of American workers would be happy with. Why did you go, Chad?
Well, you see, the thing is that there's a couple of different things. One, I think people are sold a bill of goods. Oh, I've got a 401k. Isn't that wonderful? Well, it is if you know how to use it. The reason that I left is that I was making good money, and someone who was hired way up in the company changed the corporate compensation plan. And I know that this person was probably making in excess of $4 million a year. And I was, you know, doing okay, and they wanted to cut my pay by about 20%. And this is after 10 years of work. I was the top producer. They were going to send me to Key Largo and put me up in a 5-star hotel with my wife for the weekend as part of, I don't know how you would call
it. And then cut your pay 20%. Have a nice weekend.
Exactly. Well, you know, the thing is that, you know, I can understand this corporate profit margin. Everybody needs to make money. That's why we're in business. But at the same time they're cutting my pay, I'm reading in the newspaper that corporate profit, the profit of my company, is up 25%.
And down your pay may go. Chad, thanks for that. Let's get one more call here from Fairfield, Vermont. Al, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. Great show. I'm frustrated by the superficiality of the analysis of our economy in this country. In the latest poll in terms of common good, the United States came 23rd or 24th. Denmark was first on the list. We have a form of capitalism in this country which has been termed in the past dog-eat-dog, eliminating regulations of financial services. Over in Europe, workers commonly get 5 to 6 weeks paid vacation, subsidized child care, free education, on and on it goes.
Al, our time is short. Do you hear something turning on this in the presidential campaign? Do you hear a conversation about this? This is the great national democratic debate.
No, and I'm about to use a very dirty word, and that's Karl Marx. Marx analyzed this 150 years ago, that under the capitalist system we have in this country, inevitably you're going to have the underclass sinking, and you're going to have polarization of wealth and growing immiseration. The social democracies of Europe have solved that problem by a collaboration between government and the private sector. That's the point I wanted to make.
Al, thanks very much for that. Stephen, Al's reaching all the way back to Marx here. Is there something in the middle distance that where you see a hope beyond the goodwill of a few private companies or not?
Oh, hopefully, I want to go back to what a caller, the female caller said two or three calls ago.
She said, half a minute, so go straight to it.
She said, you know, there's something wrong with what people are learning in business school, that it has to change. And there's so much focus on, you know, maximizing profit, minimize payroll, that I think too many business school graduates forget that, you know, the people working for them have to support families. They need not to be too stressed out. And I think it would be great if there were somehow some change in attitude by management. I'm not saying companies shouldn't be profitable. They should. They need to be profitable. But they could probably do more to make lives easy for their workers.
Well, here's a new book for the business school syllabus, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Read it and weep, but maybe get a little bit mad and do something. Stephen Greenhouse, thank you so much for the book and for being with us.
Very nice to be here. Thanks much, Tom.
Jack Beatty, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.